1982, talking to Judge Robert Gutschieber. I'd like to just start out with very basic questions of where you were born and where your early schooling was.
I was born in New York City and October 2, 1917, and I moved around quite a bit in that my early years. My mother was from Georgia, and we went down there and lived for 3 years. Then we moved back to Brooklyn. Then we lived in Philadelphia, and then when I was about 9 years old, we came to Ithaca, New York, where my father was director of public relations for Cornell University. Mm-hmm. And I stayed in Ithaca and going to grade school and high school there, and then went to Cornell University and Cornell University Law School, at the conclusion of which time I entered the Army. So that was basically where I was located during my early years.
Why did you decide to become a lawyer?
Oh, I think I had leanings towards the law from when I was fairly young. I had an uncle who was a lawyer, whom I admired, and I think I more or less just gravitated towards it, is what it amounted to. At Cornell, we were able to combine our senior year as an undergraduate with the first year of law school, and I elected to do that. Which was kind of a tough decision because I was playing football and had to decide whether to play a final year of football or to go into the law school. And I decided on the latter, which was very fortunate because I graduated in 1941, which was just before World War II. And I started to go to work in New York City. I never intended to practice there entirely, but thought I could get some good experience, and I was there a week when I received notice for the Army. This was in the pre-war draft, and I went into the Army in August of 1941.
Who were you working for in New York City?
It was a firm of Nordlinger, Riegelman, and Cooper was the name of the firm. It was a medium-sized firm, but quite an active one.
But you hadn't planned on working in New York
City? I didn't want to be there permanently, but I thought that it was an excellent place to get some good experience.
Mm-hmm. What kind of law were you going to start in?
I was just looking for general practice and general law. I had no thoughts about specialization. I did think that I'd like to get into litigation.
Mm-hmm. Where were you stationed in the Army?
Well, I started at Fort Niagara in New York State and then went down to Camp Wheeler in Georgia, and I was there when Pearl Harbor occurred. I remember that very vividly. And shortly after that, I was accepted for officer candidate school, and I went to Fort Benning on their 13-week for becoming an officer, and our class was the 7th officer candidate class, and the first one that sent any people overseas directly from graduation. And there were 6 of us that were selected, and we 2 of them went to Newfoundland, and the other 4 went to Greenland, and I was one that went to Newfoundland. And I was stuck there for 2.5 years. Then I returned to the United States and helped train troops in Georgia until the end of the war. I didn't get in any real action.
You were in Newfoundland?
Yes.
For
2.5 years.
After the Army, where did you?
Then I started to go into with the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and I heard of an opportunity to come up to Juneau as Assistant United States Attorney, and thought it would be interesting and decided to come up.
What were you doing with the Justice Department?
I did nothing with them. I interviewed for a job, and I had the opportunity of going in with them in their claims department, and the U.S. attorney sounded more exciting.
In Juneau, who was Folta the U.S. attorney?
No, at that time there was no U.S. attorney here. The last U.S. attorney had left under somewhat of a cloud. And when I was interviewed by Bob Bartlett in Washington, D.C., and at the same time, Patrick Gilmore was coming out of the Navy, and he was selected to be the U.S. attorney, and I was selected to be his assistant. And I arrived here on January 16, 1946, and at that time, there was an unsolved murder that had occurred in one of the better residential areas on the hill, where a fellow named, well, they didn't even know who what his name was found with his throat cut, and this had the whole town at that time very much excited, and that was the first case we had when we hit Juneau. Patrick came just about the same time I did, and we had that trial. In fact, the trial lasted for 3 weeks, and we had the closing argument the day that my wife and little baby came to join me in Juneau, and I wasn't even able to get out to the airport to meet them. But that was a very, very interesting trial. The FBI at that time investigated the serious territorial crimes, and there was an FBI agent named Delias who actually lived down in the South Franklin Street in some of the, at that time they had some rather seamy boarding houses, and he developed this entire case, which was circumstantial, that resulted in the conviction of Meeks. At that time we had capital punishment, and the jury stayed out overnight on that question, and then found him guilty with leniency so that he didn't have the capital punishment. I don't know how much detail you want on this thing, but one of the things that happened in the trial, there was a fellow who was delivering telegrams for the Alaska Communication System, which handled our telegrams at the time. You'd go around in sneakers. Older man, he seemed older at that time. I guess I wouldn't think so now. And it turned out that he had been a great trial lawyer who had tried some of the Teapot Dome cases and some of the other big cases. And he decided to make the Meeks case his comeback and got permission to participate. I think he had had an alcohol problem and hit the skids. And he was a very clever trial lawyer and very able one. It was quickly apparent.
Do you remember his name?
It was J.J. O'Leary is my recollection. And he baited the judge, who was Judge Kehoe, who was a visiting judge at that time from Anchorage. He eventually, I think I objected to a question, and the judge upheld my objection, and O'Leary repeated the question in a little different form, and the judge told him if he asked that question one more time, he'd be held in contempt. And the judge, O'Leary, asked it in a slightly different form, and the judge held him in contempt and threw him out of the trial in the presence of the jury. And as a result, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which handled all our appeals at that time, reversed the conviction, and the case had to be retried. At that time, I was in private practice, and I was called back as a special assistant to the Attorney General to participate in the retrial. And we had to bring one witness back from Germany, and another witness was in Japan, and the case again took 3 weeks to try. And the jury stayed out overnight again on the issue of whether to give him capital punishment, and it came out exactly the same way the second time. But in the meantime, O'Leary had been killed in a plane crash, and he did not participate in the second trial. Henry Roden did participate, who was a great, I don't know if you've had much about him. Well, he was, at one time, was the attorney general, I think, and he was treasurer also for the state, and he was in the first legislature, and he was one of the great old men at the time I first came here.
What kind of law was he practicing?
He practiced, he represented labor unions a lot, and he practiced general, everyone practiced general law, I think, in those days. There weren't many specialists as such. Henry came from Switzerland, and he had a fairly definite accent, but he was very clever and very shrewd in his approach to questions.
Mm-hmm. So your first case, that was your first case?
That was the first case that I had to try, and Patrick and I tried it together.
Mm-hmm. Did you work fairly closely together?
Yes, we did. I mean, there were the two of us here, and so it was a very close relationship, and also Patrick and his wife, Lena, who has passed away now, were just very friendly to me when I first came here. And before my wife came, I had about half my meals with them, I remember.
Were there any other assistant DAs around?
Not in Juneau. As I recall, we had an assistant in Ketchikan. You know, I can't even think right now who was Patrick. Bob Jernberg was an assistant U.S. attorney, and he came up and participated in some of the work, and then he went into private practice before very long with Lester Gore in Ketchikan. We used to go down the whole court in Ketchikan for about a month in the fall every year, and that was about the extent that we held criminal trials there. We had the grand jury and held the trials at that time.
What about the rest of the year? How did they handle their cases, or did they send them up to you?
If something emergency came, they had an assistant district attorney that was down there that took care of things as they came up.
How long were you in the attorney?
I was until October of 1947, which would be a little less than 2 years. And also, as a matter of fact, the district attorney would go down to Ketchikan occasionally when things were urgent. And for the most part, we went on the Alaska steamship for that type of travel at that time, which was a much more leisurely and pleasant way than taking the small planes. I remember one time Pat went down to Ketchikan, and I was left in Juneau, and Juneau was usually quite a peaceful town with not too much criminal activity. We had 3 murders in that week while he was gone, and they were quite bizarre ones. Several of them were. One involved a fellow who was from one of the best families, I don't know what you call best families, but from a very prominent family in San Francisco, whose brother was a partner in the largest law firm there. And he had murdered the woman whom he had been living with, who also was from a prominent California family, by wrapping a stocking around her neck and choking her to death. And we had a lot of cases where people that were accused of the crime would get up to the point of committing the crime, and then they'd say they blacked out, couldn't remember. His was just the opposite. He remembered the details of choking her and couldn't remember anything that happened before or anything that happened immediately after it.
So did you do the trials for the 3 murder cases?
I participated in them. One involved a fellow named Ashby, who was the oldest resident in point of time in Juneau. He was in his late 80s at the time and had come here and just after Juneau was founded, shortly after 1980, and his son had been out drinking and partying and came home with another fellow, and the old man ordered the other fellow out of the house, and when he didn't go, he finally shot him and killed him. And the trial, of course, involved a question of whether it was self-defense or not. The jury, I tried that one, and the jury, Ashby had never had any kind of criminal record in all of his 80-some-odd years until this incident. The jury, again, had a hard time with it and brought an acquittal in, which I was very, very pleased to see, although I had done my best in presenting the evidence against him.
What were the juries like at the time? What were their biases?
I don't think they were much different from juries as they are today. Generally, my impression was that we had fairly good juries from the standpoint of being fairly well-reasoned and fairly intelligent for the most part. Of course, Juneau has always been a government town and had probably a higher percentage of educated people, that people with higher educations than a lot of places would have.
So they didn't, earlier in the years, they would, Bill Stump was saying that they wouldn't convict people for bootlegging, that sort of thing, because people just didn't think
that it was a crime.
That it was a crime.
And they used to have a lot of trouble on fisheries cases convicting fishermen, because they were all of them more or less together. Though I remember one case, I had to go over to Sitka to try a fishing case, and we went over on the Grizzly Bear, the boat, overnighted on the way, and finally got there and tried the case. And that was a case where a fellow had blocked off the stream to catch the salmon as they were coming up the stream, and we did get a conviction on that one.
Was that a lucky conviction, or did the other people think he was taking their fish?
I think maybe the people thought he was hurting the fish stock, and that he had gone just too far. It wasn't a question of just starting fishing a little early or going over a line or something of that nature.
Yeah. Who was the judge while you were an assistant U.S. attorney?
Well, Judge Folda was the principal judge here, and as I say, we had visiting judges. When I first came here, the judge was that had been appointed was Judge Alexander, and he was ill, and in fact, he wasn't even in Juneau while I was here. And then we had visiting judges from time to time. Judge Pratt came down at one time from Fairbanks, Judge Kehoe. I think Judge Holtheimer had Judge Holtheimer was not a judge here at that time, but he was practicing, well, more or less practicing law. He was practically retired. There was Judge Kehoe, of course, who came down. Judge Kehoe was a very fine artist as well as being a judge.
Yeah. What was the difference between the judges that you had? I mean, did you approach them differently when you had cases?
Oh, and then Judge Kelly, he came later, Judge Kelly did, while I was in private practice. I don't know, as you approach them very, very differently. Judge Folda, of course, had been a prosecutor, and I think that he had a feeling that things, that the law was pretty well stacked in the defense favor. Judge Folda, however, was very good on issues of law and on evidence. And I tried a number of cases before him after I went into private practice, too. And he used to amaze me about how well-versed he was in issues that you'd have to bone up on to be prepared to give your argument, and that you wouldn't be ones that would be readily apparent, and yet he'd be right on top of them. But I can remember one case, John Rader came down to try, it was about his first case, and we went to pick the jury, and I represented a Juneau, I think it was Tom Morgan that I was representing. I'm not sure whether it was Tom or whether it was someone else. No, it was Whitey Thorpe I was representing. And the jurors, almost every one of them, said they knew him well, but that it wouldn't influence them in any way, and they could be a fair and impartial jury. So I ended up with 12 good acquaintances of my client who were fair and impartial jurors. And at that point, John moved to dismiss the jury because he had been the one that had requested the jury, and I had not requested a jury trial. And I objected that he couldn't do it at that point, but Judge Folda ruled that he could dismiss the jury. And the jury was dismissed. We took a recess, and when we came back, Judge Folda admitted that he was wrong and that it was improper to admit the jury. And he gave me the choice of going ahead with the trial. I represented the plaintiff, or without a jury, or else having the case go over, which would mean probably a year's delay. So after consulting with my client, we went ahead with the trial, and we finally won anyway. That was the one time I thought I had the perfect jury.
What was Judge Pratt like?
I tried, as I recall, just one case for him, and he had a bad problem with vision and had a little brown, but used to wear a visor to help protect his eyes. He was quite, my recollection, he was quite strict in running the court. And I think, one time an attorney asked him for the reason why he gave a ruling, and he advised the attorney that he wasn't conducting a law school, that he didn't need to inquire as to his reasons.
Where did he normally hold court?
Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm. How did they switch around? What was the system?
Well, it was just filling in like they do with the district courts today. The district courts will fill in when there's a need for them in another location. Mm-hmm.
Judge Kelly, did you practice? He was there after you were attorney.
Yes, that's right. He was while I was in private practice. He was a former commander of the American Legion and a very distinguished individual. I think Judge Kelly may still be alive. I don't know. He later took a job, I don't know whether railway commission or something of that nature. Mm-hmm. But he was a very distinguished-looking gentleman, and was a very, we had generally very good judges here, and he was very fair. I remember I had one case. I represented a person who lost his boat, and we were suing the Coast Guard for negligence, one of the early cases under the Federal Tort Claims Act. And the Coast Guard had the place filled with brass almost every day of the trial. Mm-hmm. And I was very apprehensive that Judge Kelly, with his military background, would give me a bad time. But he eventually ruled for us, so mm-hmm. I was very pleased with that one.
Why did you decide to go into private practice after being in the U.S. Attorney's office?
Well, I never planned on making a career of being in the U.S. Attorney's office. I thought it was a good place to get some trial experience, which it certainly was, because we tried a lot of cases at that time. And I had an opportunity to go into practice with Norman Banfield and Bert Faulkner, mm-hmm. and it seemed to be an attractive one. After discussing it with my wife at great length, we hadn't decided really whether we'd stay in Alaska or not when we came up. We decided I decided to make the move and went into private practice.
Why did you decide to stay in Alaska?
Well, I always liked it. I'm an outdoor person. I love the beauty of it. I like fly fishing. I like hiking. I like skiing, and so it was just the type of life I enjoyed, and I enjoy living in a friendly, smaller community where you don't have long commutes and some of the problems with the big cities.
Mm-hmm. Were you the first partner that Faulkner and Banfield had?
Yes, they were the two of them, and mm-hmm. of course they were partners, and
yeah.
then. I was the first time they took in a third person.
How did they handle, what was the administration of it like?
I came in on a salary basis, and they were very, very generous. I never asked for a raise, and all the time I was there, they always increased it, and then I became a partner eventually in it. And it was a very, very pleasant association. I always felt free to go in and discuss cases with either of them, and particularly Bert Faulkner, who was even at that time one of the senior members of the bar. Bert was very much of a gentleman. His whole life centered around the law, and I know when I first started working for the firm, I had the idea that as the young lawyer, I should be the first one in the morning and the last one to leave at night. And first day, I think I got there at 9:15. Bert was there, and I tried 8:30, and he was there, and I tried 8, and he was there, and I gave up. And the same thing, he came almost every night. He worked almost every night. He was devoted to his family and church and so forth. He was also very, very active in the Masonic Lodge. But at one time, Bert tried 9 jury trials back to back and won all 9 of them, representing the Alaska Juneau gold mine and in personal injury cases. And he tried a lot of a wide variety of cases. He was a self-taught lawyer, and said just a tireless worker. And he also did things such as if any acquaintance was in the hospital, he'd be sure to visit them. And he was a very generous man, and generous both with his time and with his as well as helping people out that needed help.
Both Faulkner and Fulta were self-taught to some degree.
Banfield was too. Banfield took his law degree. I mean, he went to Wisconsin University, but he acquired his law admission to the law through practice with Faulkner.
Uh-huh. Well, did you notice any difference in the way they practiced from the way you did with your education?
Not really, no. Of course, I think both of them were very able, and they were good students of the law.
So there were no gaps?
I really didn't notice it. I have noticed that with some of the others, a few of the others who did not have formal legal training, and I am a great believer in formal legal training, but as far as Bert or Norman, I did not notice any gaps at all.
Did they ever feel like they had to overcompensate, that they learned it better than other people because they didn't have the education?
I really don't know. Of course, at the time that Bert did it, I think it was common practice to study law with someone and become a lawyer that way. It wasn't quite that much when Norman undertook it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they had any feelings of that type.
Who did Bert Faulkner study under?
Now, I don't know that. He was the U.S. Marshal at one time, and there were some colorful stories on that. He was in Ketchikan and handled that job, and then he studied for the law and became a lawyer. And Bob Robertson, who was the other, Bert and Bob were more or less the two leading attorneys at the time, their offices were, though there was also Howard Staber's office. And I believe Bob Robertson was a court reporter originally and then studied law. He's the father-in-law of Fred Eastaugh.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me some of the stories of
the early days?
Yeah,
it's too bad you couldn't have asked Norman, because he has a much better recollection of them than I have. I'm trying to remember one story where a fella tried to beat him up, and I think Bert took him and hauled him to jail in a wheelbarrow. There's some such story as that, but I don't really remember the details of it.
Why did Bert Faulkner come up to Alaska? Did he ever talk about it?
I don't know that. He was, my recollection is he was born in Nova Scotia and then became a United States citizen and then came on up. And I think he was assistant marshal and then became marshal.
Yeah. What kind of clients did Faulkner Banfield have when
They had a wide variety. They had quite a the basis of the practice was a retainer client practice, and then they accepted other types of work, but they represented a lot of the large canneries And they represented part in a lot of companies that wanted a representation in the Capitol. And then there would be cases, of course, that would come into the office.
Did their work entail a lot of lobbying for the legislature?
They did some, but not a tremendous amount. I did very little of it. I represented one or two clients, and then I quit that altogether and didn't do any lobbying. And my practice became more and more oriented towards trial work, mm-hmm. although would still take, you know, they're in a small community, you have to take almost anything on. In fact, sometimes there'd be cases that would just be dogs that the other attorneys had turned someone down and they needed representation, so you'd take the case and just do with it what you could, where it was a legitimate case, even though it didn't bring in any real revenue or anything of that nature.
What was the billing like? What, can you compare it to the fees?
Well, I can remember a long time that our charge was $10 an hour. And I can remember also that we used to do title checks. We'd go up and check the title to property, check through the mortgage books, the liens books, and check the title back to patent. And we'd give a certificate of title on it, which we could be held liable for, and we were charging $10 and $15 for those, which in retrospect was foolhardy, if nothing else. In fact, I can remember one time, too, we took care of a rather delicate matter for a firm from outside and were very successful, but it didn't take very long, and I think the bill was something like $75, and they wrote back and said they thought we were an eleemosynary institution instead of a law firm. A charitable institution.
Did you compare your billing rates to other people practicing in Alaska at the time at all?
Oh, I think we did a little bit. Of course, they had minimum fee schedules then, too. And usually you try to keep your fee, charge the minimum fee is about what we did. Though if there was something unusual, why, you'd add to it. And then the practices fortunately changed, and there were a little bit higher fees were charged as the years went by. And we got into more plaintiffs' work as time went on, too, with the contingent fee cases. Mm-hmm. We didn't have very many of those when I first was in the office.
How much was a contingent fee? What percentage?
Usually we charged a third if it went to trial and 25% or less if it was settled before trial.
Mm-hmm. How long were you with Faulkner Mason?
I was with them until I became a judge in the Alaska Supreme Court in 1972. Okay. So it was 25 years.
Over the time period, did your practice change? Did the kind of things that you were doing change?
I don't think, well, other, yes, it did. So when I started out, I handled a lot of workmen's compensation cases, for example. The firm had a large number of insurance clients, and we handled those. Then Frank Dugan came into the firm, and he took them over, and I got out of that area of the law. Though when I first did it, the act was relatively new, and we had a lot of cases that went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on legal points which was a nice feature of the territorial days, because all our appeals went there, and we had quite an extensive practice. I can remember trying four or five appellate arguments before them in a year or so, so that we had great deal more of a Circuit Court of Appeals practice than most attorneys had.
How long did it take for you to make partner in Faulkner?
You know, I think I became partner in 1949, as I recall.
And you started with them in
47. Right.
Did it change as time went on?
Yes, we started taking in a few more attorneys, and I think there were eight in the office when I became a judge.
How did the how did you partners determine when to have more attorneys? Did you regularly hire one a year? Or?
No, it wasn't on any basis like that. If we partially, I think, if someone came around and we thought they were seemed to be a good prospect, why we'd take them in. I don't recall it being very organized on any systematic basis, or on. We always seem to have a little more work than we can conveniently handle, so there wasn't really. That wasn't too much of a factor. There were, at one time, our offices originally were over the 20th Century Grocery Store. In fact, there's a good story about Norman. Incidentally, I'm going to have to knock this off pretty soon, too, because I can't keep going on this, but I could go on quite a while. Harold Bates was the owner of the grocery store at that time, and he had a case, and Norman was called as a witness in the case. And they asked Norman if he didn't have some kind of a retainer basis with the grocery store and Harold Bates there. And Norman said, well, not really. He said that Harold needs advice. Once in a while, he comes up to see me. And if I want an apple, I go down there.
When you were working for them, my train of thought. Did you ever have any contact with Bill Arnold?
Yes, particularly in the early days there. He represented the canned salmon industry, and our firm represented some of the canned salmon companies. And Bill Arnold would discuss cases that involved them. There was Bert Faulkner represented them to a large extent on those cases. I think there was a case on the unemployment compensation and on the basis for determining seasonal workers that was quite an extensive one that Bert handled, and I think that Arnold was interested in that. And there was a case that I worked on the no, I guess not on that. I don't trying to remember another one there. Mm-hmm.
Did you split your clients? Like, did Bert Faulkner have the fisheries?
To quite an extent, we did. I represented Columbia Lumber Company and Alaska Plywood Corporation, but we would all help out on, you know, if there was, for instance, if Bert was busy and had a particular issue, why he would ask me to do it, and same thing with Norman. He handled the Alaska Alaska Electric Light Company. He handled quite a few large corporations, and he also, for years, has managed one of the large office buildings, sort of acted as the attorney and manager, overall supervisor for the owner for it.
Did the firm get into corporate work? Some firms in Anchorage have gotten into real estate and other things besides just practicing law and representing clients. Did you? Not really.
We did. We represented corporations. We formed corporations, also nonprofit corporations. The closest thing to what you're saying is that the management of that one building, which, and it wasn't the actual management, it was sort of acting as supervisor and representative of the absentee owners on it.
What were bar activities like down here?
Well, we had our weekly bar luncheon, and I can remember in the early days, everyone used to go to them. They were generally in the Baranoff when I was there. They had been in other places before that, but and I can remember old Judge Holtheimer, who was still around then, and Al White, who was an FBI man in the very early days of the FBI, and was a very big, husky man who was in real estate as well as in law practice. Bob Robertson used to go regularly. Judge Helenthal, Cy Helenthal, was down here practicing in the early days I was here, and he would attend the bar lunches. Mildred Herman, have you heard much about her?
Yeah.
Well, she was the first lady lawyer here, and was a great, great, great woman. Was very bright and sharp, and she was quite a jury arguer. She had good rapport with the juries. She was a big woman, very big woman.
What kind of cases did she normally handle?
I think it would be more of what the plaintiff-oriented lawyer would have today. We weren't as much structured on that way, but I think she handled more of that type of case. Then there were Howard Stabler, who I was married to Gladys Stabler, who became a lawyer too, and they had she was a rather shy, very gentle person who didn't actively practice much, but sort of ran the office for him. Then a little later, Bob Annis came. I don't know whether anyone's mentioned him or not. He was a good trial lawyer with the Robertson firm, and who passed away in Anchorage about 5 or 6 years ago. He had from when he was very young, had a very pretty head of white hair, almost snow white hair, that was part of his, you'd notice very, very, very quickly, and very, made him very striking appearing.
Did the bar have any kind of activities besides meeting?
Well, we had a yearly picnic, and there's some, I don't know if you've seen some of the pictures of the old bar. In fact, I have probably the same one I have. And we used to meet out at somebody's cabin, different cabins, and then they were great occasions where we'd all sit around and swap yarns, and had a very good time on that. The bar, later days, after they had Law Day, we always conducted Law Day ceremonies. And then there were always the activities on the admission of the attorneys. When I took the Alaska Bar, I was the only one taking it in Juneau, and they gave it to me in my office. When I was Attorney General. That was in 1947.
Who administered it?
I think the Territorial Attorney General did. And I don't, they had a few people taking it in Anchorage, and then they graded them, and eventually we went before the judge for oral examination, but at that time they didn't really give any oral examination to me, at least. I was worried about it, but he just admitted me.
So they didn't even ask
you? No, not on the oral part, no.
Do you remember how the Integrated Bar Act came about?
I remember it coming about, and that most of us favored it, and that's about all I remember about it.
So things that led up to it?
No, I don't. I don't recall actively participating in it. I have no real recollection. Let's see, what year was that passed?
55.
55, yeah. I remember, I have no real good recollection as to the how it came about.
Do you remember the Stump case in about 53 or 54?
Yeah, very well. Bill was on the Alaska Development Board, and the same board that I was on. And he got in an argument with Bill Boardman in the Elks Club. I think it was over the Alaska Development Board, if I'm not mistaken. Bill certainly could tell you much better than I could.
No, he can't.
And he can't, or he wouldn't. Well, I guess I'm less reticent on it. And I think he threatened to see that Boardman got no more insurance business in Ketchikan or something of that nature. That was the story anyway.
Was Boardman insurance?
He was insurance, and they were both in the bar at the Elks Club, and it was more of a just a little, an argument that got heated is about what it amounted to. Anyway, it was reported to the judge, and they had procedures against Bill. In fact, I think I was a witness for Bill in the thing, and I don't, that's about the extent of what I remember on it.
Were there many disciplinary cases before statehood?
Well, there were a few. I can remember some lawyers who, particularly drinking was a problem with some lawyers, and they were would be disbarred for it. And I don't, I guess it all went through the judge is what it went through, as I recall, though I have no, haven't checked it out to refresh my recollection on it. I really can't think of any others right at the moment.
But people were disbarred for drinking.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember anything?
That's something I wouldn't want to give a name on.
Mm-hmm. Was the Stump case one of the things that led to the Integrated Bar Act?
I never heard of that.
Yeah.
I never heard of that.
Heard
no,
of
that theory. that was what led to it. No.
Yeah. Or that it was anything that made the bar think that the judges shouldn't be disciplining
lawyers.
Right.
I never heard that. So or if I did, I don't remember it.
After the Integrated Bar Act was passed, did it change the practice at all? Was there any? Did it have an effect on discipline and that sort of thing?
I really can't say that I noticed any immediate effect of it or any change in it. And of course, what happened, of course, is that the number of attorneys increased tremendously, and the problems increased. Lawyers didn't know each other as well, and particularly in Anchorage, where you got really a large bar, there weren't the courtesies extended to each other that there used to be. And I think the things changed. When the disciplinary matter of Leo McKay came up, and as I recall, we had a fairly spirited discussion about the case in the Board of Governors, and there was a 4-2 vote not to take any action on it. I was, as president, was not able to cast a vote, because you only cast a vote if there was a tie. And later, there was a reference to it in one opinion, which Judge Ahrens wrote, which indicated that all of the members of the board had voted and so forth. And I wrote to Judge Ahrens about it, pointing out that under our rules we didn't. And he wrote a very generous correction on it. Judge Ahrens, of course, was the one who was caught in the crossfire on the thing, which I always thought was a tragedy, because he was a very fine individual. And I really think it probably almost broke him, the fact that he didn't get reelected and he didn't fight it at all. When the campaign was going on, the bar campaign. But of course, the questions arose because of the very strong Chief Justice, and I'm sure you've got all the rest of the background of it, so that there isn't really too much point in going on it.
Well, a question is, who was the Anchorage bar more up in arms against the judges than the? I mean, was there a difference between? Who was really pushing the fight in the state?
I think it probably centered in Anchorage, but it wasn't only there. I know there was a lot of feeling in Fairbanks, and there was less of it, I think, down in Juneau, and then I think Juneau got sort of brought into it more or less later, because we were a little more at a distance from it and not right embroiled in it as much as the Anchorage bar was.
Mm-hmm. How is it decided how the bar would fight the court? And who decided that they would take the matter up? Arbitration.
Well, see, my term as Board of Governors was as president was over, and I do not recall. I'm just trying to think. I think I did serve on the board. I think the outgoing president served on the board. But I don't know whether it came up that fast even, whether it didn't take the following year before the Neil McKay campaign came up and so forth. Mm-hmm. When the Judge Aaron's election came up. I was president in 62. 1961-62, so I was through in July of 62, and I think it was the 64 election, wasn't it, that, do you recall on that?
I thought it was 16, I think you might be right, 64, 65.
Yeah, somewhere in there, so that I was no longer participating with the Board of Governors, and I didn't know just exactly, I don't recall exactly. Though I'm sure that there was approval by the board of action taken.
Against Aaron.
I think so, yes, yeah. I think so. Though I, that is, that's, I don't have a clear recollection on it, so I really can't say. That should be easy to find out.
They threw out all the minutes.
Is that?
Most of the minutes the bar has been thrown out.
Isn't that something?